You're listening to Life in Deep Ellum's podcast.
I am Gina Morielli. I am the kids pastor here at Life in Deep Ellum, and I'm really happy to be with you guys. If any of you want a Bible, we don't put verses on the screen here, so raise your hand, and ushers will come by, and they'll hand you a Bible. Don't feel embarrassed. Even Joel, sometimes we need Bibles. Awesome. Okay. I want to start this morning off with a question for all of you. And the question is, how many of you guys consider yourselves social butterflies? Social butterflies. Just raise it high. Just go there. Go all the way up. Okay. Cool. All right. Everyone around you is like, oh gosh. Okay. When I was in college, I tried to find a picture of me in college, and no, I was very embarrassed looking through those. So, no picture of me. But when I was in college, social butterfly was like the perfect adjective to describe me. I remember one time my big brother was going to play in the coffee shop on campus, and he's going to play a set. And so I went to go support him. And I walk in the coffee shop, and as soon as I walk in, I'm like, oh, hey, how's it going? To like a friend I see. Hey, how's it going? How you doing? Oh, cute shirt. Oh my God, yeah, I heard about that too. Oh my, hey, hold on, I see another friend. Hold on one second. Oh my God, hey, how's it going? Oh, cute shirt. Like same, like all the same things. Like, but they were all my friends, like in the shop, and I was like, hey, and then hold on one second, and the next person, and the next, and I literally did that from the front of the shop all the way to the back. And it wasn't a big shop, but still, there's a lot of people in there. And I was just so bubbly and like really loved seeing all these people that I loved. And when I got to the back, my big brother's best friend, James, looked at me and he was like, you're ridiculous. And I was like, whatever, James, you know, like, but it's weird because looking back at myself then, you know, I got so much energy from people. And nowadays, you know, some 12, 10 years later, I still enjoy people. I enjoy my friends, things like that. But it usually takes more energy from me than giving it to me. And I had to be okay with that. Like, I had to learn to be okay with that. As I grew up, I realized that maybe I was being so bubbly and so friendly and all those things because it was the most likable way to be in most contexts, and not really because it was who I was all the time. And I feel like in society or in churches or in our families even, there are these like certain personalities that are not looked at or valued or desired as much as others. And no one's saying it outright. Like no one's like, outcast to the shy one. You know, no one's like saying that. But there's this unspoken like, oh, that guy, he's kind of like more subdued. You know, and then like if they're bubbly, they're really valued or desired. But, I mean, you heard this all this morning, which is super awesome. Here at Life in Deep Ellum, we hear over and over again that we actually need each other in each other's differences. We don't need to change everyone to look the same way. We value each other's differences. And it's because of those differences that we are whole and healthy as a family of God and that we can rightly reflect God. We need each other. Okay, so remember that. As we dive into our psalm today, we're in the psalm series, and the psalm we're diving into is Psalm 101. Okay, it's in book 4 of Psalm. Psalm 101. Give you all a little time to get there. I'm going to read through the psalm. Psalm 101. I will sing of your love and justice to you, Lord. I will sing praise. I will be careful to lead a blameless life. When will you come to me? I will conduct the affairs of my house with a blameless heart. I will not look with approval on anything that is vile. I hate what faithless people do. I will have no part in it. The perverse of heart shall be far from me. I will have nothing to do with what is evil. Whoever slanders their neighbor in secret, I will put to silence. Whoever has haughty eyes and a proud heart, I will not tolerate. My eyes will be on the faithful in the land, that they may dwell with me. The one whose walk is blameless will minister to me. No one who practices deceit will dwell in my house. No one who speaks falsely will stand in my presence. Every morning I will put to silence all the wicked in the land. I will cut off every evildoer from the city of the Lord. Bam! David, he is like intent, right? He's intent on making sure his kingdom is free from evildoers. And I can't blame him, but I have just a little problem with this psalm, okay? So David's singing about God's love and his justice, but by the end, I'm looking at him, at this psalm, and I'm like, oh, really, David? You will be careful to lead a blameless life, to not look with approval on anything that is vile. For those of you who don't know, this is the same man who looked longingly on another man's wife while she was bathing and then had that guy killed so that he could be with her. So yeah, I pretty much by the end of the psalm find myself judging King David. And he's also, by the way, seemingly making an age-old mistake of making a grand promise there's no way he could possibly keep. And sure, I guess we've all been there. Like the other day, I was hanging out with Mimo in our apartment, and I casually commented out of nowhere that Chewie, as in Chewbacca, not Chewie Matouche, my lovely friend, Chewbacca is ascended from the Ewoks, the Ewok race. I made that comment. So Mimo immediately Mimo's all, that's not true. And I'm like, yeah, it is. And he's like, no, it's not. I was like, yeah, it is. Like, very confident. I thought I got it from a reliable source. But anyway, so he says, wanna bet? Mimo fact, he likes to make insignificant bets, so watch out. But yeah, sure, I was so confident, I made the bet. Whatever, I lost, okay, it's not true. He sourced some sort of Star Wars discussion board online. Apparently, Wookiees, which is what Chewie is, are from the planet, correct me if you know it, Kashyyyk, okay. And then Ewoks, cute little Ewoks, are from Endor, different planets, not ascended from each other, whatever. Okay, so then he comes in to cash in I forgot to tell you the stakes, a massage, nice shoulder massage. I have a nine-month-old baby. Yeah, I'm sore. My back's sore. So yeah, I bet a massage. He cashes it. He tries to cash it in. I'm like, I'm not going to give you a massage. Sorry. I just bet it back because I was so confident. Okay, so small example of making the age-old mistake of making a promise you don't intend to keep, probably won't keep. But at least I was pretty much just being lazy. And David is like making a grand commitment to God to keep evildoers out of his entire kingdom. Like, whoa, you know, just wow, David. Okay, so sure, David was a sinful man. Sure, he had sinful capabilities. He needed forgiveness like you and me, okay? But he did not write this psalm as a hypocrite. He did not do that, okay? He wrote the psalm really with good, sincere intentions. He truly was trying to dedicate all of his responsibilities, all that he was responsible for as a king, to God, okay? And we see in verse 1, when he uses the words love and justice, singing of God's love and justice, those seem to be the motivators for David. God's love and justice, he's motivated by God's love and justice to make this grand commitment. So we need to learn about those two words really quick, okay? God's love and God's justice. So first of all, these two words are action-oriented words. They are not, we're not talking about them in theory. They are love and justice activated, okay? So first, God's justice. The word used here for justice is sepat. Everyone say it, sepat. That's what I do with the kids, okay. It means to roll, to follow custom and case law. So very similar to our judges might do, like you hear a case, you follow the case law, and you make a ruling according to it. But the judges of the Old Testament were called the noun form of this word, soap team, and that means saviors, little s, saviors. Because the presence of these justice these judges and a group of people, just their presence alone indicated that that group of people were free from war and oppression and threat. So these judges, when they exercised sipat justice by case law, they were calling their people free. And not only that, but the people who would otherwise be like wandering and faithless and just people who are not following the Lord, they would remain faithful thanks to the rulings of these judges. Sipat justice is the act of a judge who hears our cases in order to make rulings to keep us free and faithful. So, for the purposes of today, our definition for justice will be God hears. God hears. Justice, God hears. Okay, then the word love, God's love. The word used here for love is chesed. Chesed. Everyone say it.
Chesed.
Yeah. This is God's eternal loving kindness. God's eternal loving kindness. And after David became king, God included chesed love in the covenant he made with David. So this love is covenantal, okay? He initiated chesed love to David whenever Samuel was going to find the king, and he went to David's dad's house to find the king, and he looked at all of David's dad's sons. David was the eighth one of all the eight, and he was the most insignificant shepherd boy. And God initiated chesed love to see David's heart beyond his insignificance and call him out to be King David. So for our purposes today, love is defined as God sees. God sees, okay? So justice, God hears. Love, God sees. So yeah, God's love and justice motivated David. It motivates me to hear that. Seeing and hearing, they don't stay dormant. They become catapults for meaningful action that God created. And being a recipient of God's love and justice, it makes me want to see more of that existing in my world. I want to see more of my friends experiencing that. So that's the first thing that we find in this psalm, that we learn in this psalm, that God's love and justice towards us makes us want to become love and justice makers for our world. Okay, and David's grand expressions in this psalm reflect that. As king, he believed that God expected him to enact this type of love and justice in his household. He uses the word household in this psalm, but when he uses the word household, house, it's not just his immediate family, his house, it's the house of Israel, the people he governs, he is king over. That's what he means. He means both. Okay, he's sitting in both places in his life. And so as king, he wants the people that are sitting under his governing to experience God's love and justice. And the wicked and vile, remember Mimo's definition of wicked a few weeks back, godless. The wicked and vile will be put to silence and cut off. But he uses harsh, abrupt language. I'm not so sure you and I wouldn't be using language like that to talk about what we wish our government looked like or our nation. You know, because sometimes even I feel that rising up in me, this utter commitment to do whatever it takes to see the wicked fail on all accounts so that God's love and justice can prevail. I mean, having received that, I want to see more of it in the world. And I don't have a kingdom I rule over, but I have a city I live in. I have a neighborhood I make my home in. And you guys here in this room, even in Dallas, you guys are already living this way in a lot of ways. Okay, I'm going to call some of y'all out. Sally Frank, for instance, she's a part of our community. She works with DCAC, Dallas Children's Advocacy Center. And they work hard to see justice and healing for kids who have been victims or witnesses of crimes. Amy Nickel, she's volunteered with organizations working to see the victims of sex trafficking have justice. Jana Kelly, this month's current life group hero. She's pursuing justice in her workplace, okay? Justice for coworkers who've been wronged by other coworkers. Michael and Lisa Ibarra, they take care of their little boys, prayer. They take care of them every day. And even David Cole headed up a service project last year for these refugees to come and farm this garden. We prepared this garden for them to come and till and farm and find their dignity again. I mean, so many of you are making way for more of God's love and justice to be activated in our communities. And King David never felt more like a Life in Debellamer to me than in this psalm. But responding with action to God's love and justice, it is not the easy road. I mean, ask any of the people that I just mentioned. They would tell you it takes time you don't have, energy you've used up, and love you're not sure you know how to give. It's hard. It's easy to grow weary. I mean, just thinking about all that work makes me feel tired inside. And I want to put a little warning here, okay? Because in that weariness, there can come a temptation. And the temptation is to become a love and justice maker for the world, but then to leave God's love and justice in your bag at the door before you walk into your house, before you get home. There's that word again, house, household. David refers, yes, to him governing his house of Israel, but also being in his immediate household. Okay, so we're going there. We're not going to leave that out this morning. We're going to go there. We're going to talk about that. David uses two words to direct us into that personal place, the part where God's love and justice meets us in our intimate relationship. So we're going to jump all the way to the last verse of the psalm, and I should be giving some sort of warning here, like a spoiler alert, because normally a psalm is written where, well, and psalms are written, where the last verse is like the climactic ending, and so surely you're like, the last verse says of how David rid his kingdom of all evildoers, and it's this climax, but let's read it and see what it says. Every morning I will put to silence all the wicked in the land. I will cut off every evildoer from the city of the Lord. So there's the two words that I want us to look at. Every morning. Ah, the morning. Morning breath. Lazy eyes. You try and walk straight, you can't. You secretly wish you could be back in bed. It's a strange time of day if you think about it. But we all kind of know how David spent a lot of his mornings, actually, because in other psalms, he writes about spending his mornings in morning song. How many of you guys like to sing in the morning? Nice. I like that. Okay, two. Is there anyone else I missed? I like to sing in the morning, you know, depending on how early it is. But one of my favorite people, Kelly Clemens, she tells me a story of her daughter, Ella Clemens, who's super awesome. Does any of y'all know Ella Clemens? Ella Clemens. She's so cool. I think we have a picture of her that's really awesome. Boom. She's so funny. She's just like one of the coolest kids. But Kelly tells me about, you know, some days where Ella is just like constantly singing all day long. Like, she's like getting ready in the bathroom and she's singing, and then she's walking down the hall, she's singing in the bath, and she's dancing. And like, it's, Kelly says it's like living with someone who thinks they're in a Disney movie. So like slightly annoying, but like really cute. You know, she's just so precious. But I feel like David would like click with Ella. You know, he talks so much about singing in the morning. He sings about God's love, about God's strength, his care for him. He sings about all different types of things. And yeah, here, these two words, every morning, they help us get that picture of that morning space that David's in, where David's preparing for his day, okay? Just think about that for yourself. He's preparing for his day. And he's already thinking about how he can become a love and justice maker that day. I mean, it flows out from his personal practice at home. It flows out from there. What a beautiful picture that would be for us, right? God's love and justice freely flowing in and out of our lives, our personal relationships. I mean, our marriages would be operating out of pure, blameless hearts. We put to silence whoever slanders their neighbors when we're talking with their besties. We teach our children not to have hearts full of pride. When we're even talking to our parents, not to practice deceit, to see God's love and justice guide us even in our relationships with ourselves. But every day, I mean, like every day, every morning, and talk about hard work. And I don't know about y'all, but when it comes to my family, I get kind of protective, kind of feisty, okay? Like when I was growing up, if I thought my mom did something like kind of corny or like mom-like, you know, I was cool with like talking to my friends like, oh, my mom, you know, she did that thing. So funny, that's my mom. But the second any of my friends were like, dude, your mom did this thing, I was like, I'm sorry, what'd you say? You can't talk about my mom like that. You know, like very like, no, that's me and my mom. Like I'm her daughter. Like this is family. Like you have no say here. But I get like that with God. When it comes to my personal stuff and like my intimate relationships, like I get like that with him. Oh God, you said what about me and my husband's relationship? You said what about my resentments, bitterness towards my parents? Oh, no, you're not welcome here. That's gonna be too hard. There's too much pain there. And when God's love and justice is welcome to reign and rule in our most intimate relationships, there can be a lot of pain uncovered. God's love and justice tends to do that. The weariness we talked about that's so familiar to a love and justice maker in the public sector sinks deeper still as we consider seeing God's love and justice activated in our intimate relationships, even in our relationships with ourselves. And so the second thing we find in the psalm is that there's a pain that comes with pursuing God's love and justice. There's a pain that comes with pursuing God's love and justice, with being a love and justice maker for your world. There's a quote I chose to talk about pain today, and it's a quote from Mother Teresa, something she said. First of all, Mother Teresa, this woman who the whole world looks at as this ultimate being to become, and she pretty much lived and existed to see God's love and justice enacted, right? But she says this. She says, they say people in hell suffer eternal pain because of the loss of God. In my soul, I feel just that terrible pain of loss, of God not wanting me, of God not being God, of God not really existing. What do I labor for? So let's look back at Psalm 101. We're going to read verse 2. I will be careful to lead a blameless life. When will you come to me? I will conduct the affairs of my house with a blameless heart. In verse 2, there's a poignant question David asks. When will you come to me? This portion is the only question in the whole psalm. And just for a moment, we sense this unsureness in David's tone. If this psalm was a song, the note played just there for the small line, it might sound dissonant as it eerily squeezes its way through the confidence of the words that precede and follow. And just for a moment, we hear David plea. When will you come to me? It's a question of time. How much longer? There's a pain that comes with the desire to see love and justice made real in our world and in our personal lives, isn't there? It's this pain of searing loss, of God maybe not being real. The pain of seeing things as they are and as they can be. And in between the moments of confidence and determination, David expresses what our hearts know well. When will you come to me? There's this need for God to be near him. But when? And I don't want us to miss this. I don't want us to miss it even just for a moment. Okay, to see this glimpse of the great King David, confident and determined as he is, and yet in the same moment, poor, needy, longing for God's presence. The sooner that we can stand in solidarity with David in this moment and admit that in the middle of doing the good work, in the middle of the mornings of preparation, and right in the middle of our confidence, we actually all have this intimate need for God to be near to us in our pain. That's the closer that we will be to extending real hope to others in their pain. Here, we don't look to David as a portrait of morality for us. We look to him as a mirror of identity. He identifies himself as one in need. In need of what? Of God's presence to make his home with him. In need of God's nearness, the nearness of God. And so that's the third thing we find in the psalm. God's nearness brings us hope for the pain, brings us hope in the pain. Some of us feel like the nearness of God is a mockery to our very pursuits of love and justice. Like, if he's so near, why is there such a need for justice to happen in our world? Where is he? What is he doing? It mocks our efforts. That's what it feels like. I've had those feelings too. I can relate with that. I pretty much ask myself all those questions annually, if not daily, for the past 5 years. Mimo and I have experienced a lot of pain the past 5 years. We've had 4 deaths of friends and family. We've both been through mental illness, in and out. We've had threats of death and illness to our fathers. And that's not even as bad as some of your stories get. I know that. God's nearness often feels like it mocks our pursuits of love and justice in this world. But it's my hope today that David's understanding of God can inform our questioning. And we've already discovered a portion of that today, but all throughout the Psalms, David uses language to talk about God as a God of action. A God of action. A God who's living, not like the dead idols of all of the nations that surrounded him. A God who is living. He was the maker of it all, the heavens and the earth, the ultimate king over the house of Israel, who would reign longer than David would, for forever. In Psalms 5:2, David even calls God my king. My king. So the nearness of God to David was a comfort to him as he sought justice and love. To be near to God was to be near to the inventor, the initiator, the prototype of a covenant lover and justice maker. And that is so challenging, you guys, because if we aren't experiencing God's nearness as comforting, what might that say about who we think God is? maybe my inexperience with the God that David speaks about, maybe that means I haven't ever really just sat with God to really know him. David's desire for God's nearness and his vulnerability in communicating it in this one question, it makes me wonder if I even trust in who God is anymore. Do you? Are you comforted by God's presence? The nearness of this justice maker, capital J, capital M, provides comfort. And it is a comfort of that mysterious four-letter word that we all cling to in the middle of injustice, hope. Hope. In October 2012, I was sitting down on the couch with Mimo, and we were living in the Philippines as sort of unspoken missionaries of sorts, and we were watching a documentary called Nefarious. And I, at the time, though, was a person who was on the brink of leaving the Christian faith behind. I had doubted my faith before, sure, but this was different. It was a deeper time for me. It was very dark. I had a glimpse into the terror and horror that this life has to offer so many people, and I just couldn't deal with that. My mind was empty. It was on empty. God's kind of like a joke, and Jesus was more of a joke to me at the time. It was a really strange time. I was asking Mimo, like, if I'm not a Christian anymore, are you still going to be married to me? Are we still going to be missionaries in the Philippines? Like, how does this all work? I was just on this very brink, and we were sitting and watching this documentary, and our eyes were glued to it. These guys from an organization called Exodus Cry had made this documentary to give this realistic view, scope of the sex trafficking industry as it existed worldwide. And it's a great documentary. If you're interested in learning more about that, I recommend it, Nefarious. But we were watching it. We had watched it all the way through. And at the end, something happened in this documentary that rocked my world. I was sitting there, and they suddenly started interviewing a few women who had come out of the sex trafficking industry. And they were asking them about their experience and how they were rescued. And one lady in particular, she had this beautiful accent. I'm not sure which country she was from, but it was like an English accent. And she said that one night she was asleep, and she had a dream. And in her dream, the Lord Jesus came to her in a garden she was walking through. And he was sitting there. And she walked up to him, and he looked at her, and she felt such peace with him. And for the first time in a man's presence, she felt loved for who she was, and she felt hope. And she would just talk with Jesus. That was her whole dream. Her dream ended, and then she'd go on in her life. She was still in the industry. I mean, then she says every night for the next 6 months, she had that same dream. Every night. And she was still in the industry. She had the dream of Jesus coming to her. And it was for 6 months preceding her exit out of the industry, her rescue. So then they start talking to all the other women and who are on this video, and they have similar accounts. Like of Jesus or God coming to them in some form or fashion and giving them hope or offering them peace and love, and in that feeling hope, they start giving these accounts, and they attribute their rescue and release and exit, they attribute all of that to God. To God. It's crazy, y'all. That is wild. So, I'm glued to the screen. I hear all that. The screen goes black. The credits roll. I jump up, and two tears are falling from my eyes, and I'm like, Mimo, I'm done. I'm good. And he's like, what? And I'm like, oh, all that, like all these months of all the denial, all the pain, all the emptiness, all the mocking of God and the mocking of Jesus. Like, I'm over that. I'm done. I'm good. I love Jesus. I'm committed. I love him. I'm never going to doubt again. I'm done. I'm good. And it, like literally in that instant, the end of that documentary like made a believer out of me. That instant, seriously, I could feel it. Just instantly, this weight lifted off. I couldn't live in a world where my life made liars out of those women, because they were saying it. They were saying it even though they were tattered and torn and had experienced such a deep hell. They had known God's nearness. They had tasted it. And God's nearness had given them hope. It turns out, which is even more of a wild thing, that this kind of testimony is not very uncommon with people saved out of the sex industry. It's super common. I was hanging out with a friend of mine who works with a nonprofit whose works with saving women out of the sex trafficking industry. And she confirmed a lot of the victims that they get in have similar accounts of somehow God meeting them. It's mysterious. And in that same conversation, that friend made this comment. She said, "What do I do with that? I mean, we're all over here busting our butts to make sure they get saved and trying so hard to get it right. And that's what their testimony is? They attribute their rescue to God? Like, we don't even know what to do with a world where God's love and justice is made real. It's too good. It's so mysterious. God's nearness gave these women hope, and it gives us hope. God's nearness does not mock our efforts. It extends our efforts into places that you and I cannot reach. God is a God of action. We can have hope in the middle of heartache, in the middle of the journey of seeing his love that sees and his justice that hears, of seeing that become reality for people, become reality for me and how I view myself, become reality for our families that are broken. We can have hope. And maybe, just maybe, the question, "When will you come to me?" is not only informed by the nearness of God, but transformed into a phrase of expectancy. When will you come to me? Because God's nearness is what will ultimately bring and sustain love and justice and hope in the middle of the pain, in the middle of your pain. So maybe you, like David, find yourself not ruling over a kingdom as a king and queen per se, but ready, in a posture of readiness, ready to take down the enemy, cut off every evildoer, and declare, "Although I am weary, no one who practices deceit will dwell in my house. No one who speaks falsely will stand in my presence." And maybe that's you today. Maybe that's you in small ways and big ways. There is one more thing that this psalm tells us. One more thing that David reminds us of that you need to hear today. Before I say what it is, I want us to see that David allows his need for God's nearness to interrupt his confident declarations in verse 2. And that prepares him to have the humility he needs to admit his need for others in verse 6. So let's look at verse 6. "My eyes will be on the faithful in the land, that they may dwell with me. The one whose walk is blameless will minister to me." Okay, what this portion is not, it is not David saying, "I would like us to all live in a Christian bubble where people believe what I believe, talk the way I talk, dress the way I dress." That is not what this portion is, okay? What this portion is a wise reflection David is making on the health of his soul on this journey and the health of his kingdom that he rules. As he pursues God's love and justice made real in this world, he reminds us, and we've heard it plenty of times today, that we cannot do this whole love and justice thing alone. We cannot. The faithful in the land will dwell with me. One whose walk is blameless will minister to me. He uses intimate language. Dwell, minister, dwell, live with me, minister to me. He uses it intentionally to communicate the closeness and the nearness that others must have in order for us to pursue a life that reflects God's love and justice. Others, they gotta have the nearness, y'all. Maybe you feel like it's a worn-out mantra. Maybe like someone forgot to pull the needle off of the broken record. But we need reminding. We're so prone to think that we can go it all alone. I personally know that I've received refreshment and encouragement from you guys, like a lot of you guys in this room. And it's never because you got it all right, or you're super cool, so I'm gonna listen to you, or you're bubbly enough for me to talk to, or you have this personality or that. It's never because of that. Those are not reasons. No, I am refreshed and encouraged by having you near me because you have been faithful. I know so many of your stories. And just in spite of all that life has thrown at you, you have remained faithful. In spite of the fear, the pain, the heartache, failure, confusion, doubt, you have remained faithful. You are the faithful that David's talking about in this psalm. Having conversations and opening myself up to you guys, people like that, it will always leave me refreshed. It will always give me hope in the middle of my pain and my weariness. So rather than pursuing love and justice from a weary place, I can now pursue that from a place of strength, the strength of hope. Because you are God's nearness to me. You are God's nearness to me. Okay, so we're gonna do something. The room split in half. We got that side and this side, right? This side, you're going to yell to that side, hey, I need you. And then this side, in response, you're going to yell over to them and look at them and say, hey, I need you too. Okay? Go. Ready?
Hey, I need you. Hey, I need you too.
All right, let's flip-flop it, okay? You're going to initiate this time and tell those people, hey, I need you. And you're going to respond to them and say, hey, I need you too. Ready? Go.
Hey, I need you.
And y'all.
Hey, I need you too.
Yeah. Yes. Hey, I need you. I need you, Allison. I need you, Lindsay. Pursuing a life that's full of God's covenant love, that sees people, sees the heart through the outward appearance, and pursues God's justice, that hears others so that we can see that they are free and remain faithful. It is hard, but God is near. He is near. He's on the move. You are not doing this alone. So surround yourself with the faithful that they may dwell with you and minister to you. I want everyone to do something that's a little awkward, but lift up your hands really big without elbowing your neighbor in the face. It's kind of a nice stretch. I had a preacher one time that I was at a church of. It's like receiving a big gift from God, okay? And I'm gonna pray. Father, my King, my friend, we wanna see your love and justice activated in our world. Please be near to us in the pain that comes with that. We need you. Thank you for giving us each other. Thank you for being near, even when we do not know it. Thank you for the psalm. Thank you for making us faithful to the work that you're already doing. Strengthen the weary lover and the weary justice maker this morning. We love you. In Jesus' name, amen. Thank you guys for having me.